This week on Daiwa, we're in Bremer County. A prominent lawyer is accused of murdering a former colleague and friend. Daiwa.
Welcome to Daiwa, the first Iowa-focused true crime podcast, where there's 99 counties and a murder in every one. These are your hosts, Beth LaVallee and Allie Tulin.
We are in Bremer County this week, Allie. Bremer County is in northeast Iowa, and it has cities like Waverly and Tripoli. Have you been there?
I don't think I have. But Waverly, like, I've definitely heard of it.
Yeah, it's a pretty big town. It has Wartburg College, where I went to, like, the only summer camp, overnight summer camp I ever went to was a singing camp. And we would go for a weekend and sing at Wartburg College.
I love it. So cool, Beth.
It was, some of the nerdiest people you'll ever meet at that camp. One of my other favorite fun facts about Bremer County is that it's named after feminist author Fredrika Bremer. She was a Finnish-born Swedish writer and feminist reformer. She was often compared to Jane Austen because she wrote realistic romantic stories of the time. She wrote a book called Sketches of Everyday Life that was really popular in Britain and in the US back in the 1840s and 50s. And also, fun little fact for you, my favorite book is Little Women. And in that book, the mom, Mrs. March, reads to her daughters from one of Bremer's books. So it's like a story within a story. Some of Bremer's other accomplishments include petitioning King Charles XIV for emancipation from her brother's wardship. At that time, all unmarried women were minors under the guardianship of their closest male relative until they married, which meant that her brother was in complete control of her finances until she got that emancipation. She wrote a novel called Hertha that prompted a social movement that granted all unmarried Swedish women legal majority at age 25. She established Sweden's first female university, and the first women's rights organization in Sweden is called the Fredrika Bremer Association after her. She often traveled to the United States when she was alive and visited throughout the Midwest as well. And finally, Fredrika, Iowa is also named after her, so she's kind of a powerhouse of a woman. Also, I found that there's a place called Sasquatch Jack's in Bremer County. It's not really an attraction or a fun fact, but it's a restaurant that's Sasquatch themed. They serve all local Iowa beer, and their most recent Instagram post says that they have $5 tenderloins, so I felt like I needed to spread the word about Sasquatch Jack's. Sounds like you can't go wrong.
Oh my gosh. Well, very fun facts. I love hearing about Fredrika and Sasquatch Jack sounds great.
I think we need to make that a must-go on our trip.
Let's do it. All right. Well, I learned about Michael Talbot, and he was born in Waverly, Iowa, and he was an actor back in the 1980s. He appeared in a few different movies and TV shows that you might have heard of, but he is most known for co-starring in the role as Detective Stan Switek on Miami Vice. He currently lives in Waverly, according to Wikipedia, too. The other fun fact is that Wartburg College is in Waverly, Iowa, like you mentioned, and they had a few notable alum. One is Jack Salzwedel, who was the CEO and board chair of American Family Insurance. And then lastly, we have Colleen Raleigh, who is from New Hampton, Iowa, which is not in Bremer County, but she graduated from Wartburg. She's an American former FBI special agent and whistleblower, which is cool. And after the September 11th attacks in 2001, Raleigh wrote a paper for the FBI director, Robert Mueller, about how the FBI headquarters had mishandled and failed to take action on information provided by the Minneapolis, Minnesota office, where she was working at the time. They had information about their investigation on one of the suspected terrorists, and he had been suspected of being involved in preparations for the suicide hijacking, similar to the December 1994 Eiffel Tower hijacking of Air France 8969. Raleigh said the failures she identified may have left the United States vulnerable to the 9/11 attacks. She jointly held the Time Magazine Person of the Year Award in 2002 with two other women, Sharon Watkins from Enron, and Cynthia Cooper from WorldCom.
Another extremely dope female person in history.
Yeah.
Okay, so we should probably get to the story here soon. It was recommended by another one of our fabulous listeners, so shout out to them. And remember, you can always submit stories on our website. So this story takes place in 1887. Back in 1887, Grover Cleveland was president, who actually signed the Dawes Act that year. If you don't remember from history class, the Dawes Act was a law that was meant to help the assimilation of Native Americans into American society, but it absolutely backfired because it didn't accommodate any of the Native American cultural needs. Also in 1887, in London, the first Sherlock Holmes book ever was published, and in Pennsylvania, the very first Groundhog Day was observed. But this story doesn't take place in Pennsylvania, it takes place in Waverly, Iowa.
The story begins with two prominent lawyers who were once friends. Willis Kingsley was a 25-year-old lawyer from Illinois. One article said, quote, he was generally respected as a man of unquestioned integrity and uprightness of characters. He was regarded as a brilliant law school graduate, very popular, and was easily elected as the county attorney. Then we have Myron Elmore Billings, or M.E. Billings, who was another lawyer and about 45 years old, also very respected around town. He had a young, beautiful wife who was actually his second wife. And there is a photo of M.E. Billings that we found. I don't know how to describe him, Beth. Any help?
He's got like one of those beards that I don't even know what you call it. It's like a chin strap, but fuller.
Yeah, like those that you see in like Civil War photos.
Yeah. Otherwise, he looks very
average.
Yeah, like a strong average man.
Okay, good. I like this description. Anyway, in 1875, Billings' first wife, who he had two children with, asked the courts for a divorce on the charge that her husband had been guilty of adultery, and he allowed her to get the divorce. By default, that meant that he was admitting the truth of the charge. In the meantime, he asked Mr. Welcher if he could date his 15-year-old daughter, and 2 days after he was divorced, he eloped and married the Welcher daughter. Billings was also known around town to not believe in God, which was unusual for the time. However, none of these events made that big of an impact of his reputation.
So back to our 1887 story. For several months prior to the event, Kingsley actually rented out a room at the home of Billings, and the two men shared an office together at Kingsley's office. Then, on December 21st, 1887, Billings storms into Kingsley's office and confronts him. Here is the story according to Billings. For a few weeks, Billings had suspicions that Kingsley and his wife were too intimate. He made charges against his wife, who said she acknowledged her guilt, but promised to have nothing more to do with Kingsley. On October 12th, Billings moved out of Kingsley's office after having some words with him. Then, in mid-December, he wrote Kingsley a decoy letter announcing that Billings was out of the city and signed the letter D, which was his wife's initial. In reply, he got from the post office a long letter from Kingsley addressed to his wife, in which he urged her to see him. On the evening of December 21st, Billings called at Kingsley's office with the letter and was ordered out. When Billings told Kingsley of the trick that had been played on him, Billings claims that Kingsley drew a revolver and attempted to fire at him. The revolver missed fire, and Billings ran out of the office and downstairs. Kingsley made the second attempt to shoot him, and the bullet lodged in his back. Billings claims Kingsley then committed suicide by shooting himself. There were no witnesses to the shooting. Billings runs down to the street and is clearly injured, which is the first time he sees other people. When citizens ran upstairs to see Kingsley, he was dead.
One theory is that Billings went to confront Kingsley and threaten him in order to make him sign papers that said he was guilty of seduction. About a month prior to this incident, Billings had Kingsley arrested for seduction. He created this story and convinced a local woman named Miss Shane to sign a warrant saying that Kingsley seduced her. Later, she confessed that Billings compelled her to sign the warrant and that it was false. It seemed like Billings was trying to systematically ruin Kingsley's reputation.
On December 31st, the coroner's jury brought in a verdict and Billings was arrested for first-degree murder. A few months later, while Billings was in jail, the Gazette interviewed him. The article said, quote, Billings appeared quite hopeful. He said he was innocent of the crime charged and that he could not find anything whatever in reviewing the evidence given before the coroner's jury that could convict him. Mrs. Billings was in the cell with her husband, acting as his amanuensis and assisting in copying evidence from the voluminous documents which accumulated during the inquest. The law makes no provision allowing prisoners to use the evidence pro or con relative to their case, but in this instance, the representatives of the law and the people are willing and anxious that the accused should have every opportunity to defend himself and prepare for trial, so that if convicted, the defense will have no regret whatever that they were not allowed every privilege in preparing a defense, and the prosecution at the same time feel assured that they had given the other side every possible opportunity in the world to vindicate themselves. This is the feeling of the attorneys for the prosecution. Mrs. Billings has a holy horror for newspaper men and urgently counseled her husband to have nothing whatever to say to the reporter. She sat near him and continued nudging him in the back while he was conversing, and when she was fearful that he might say a little too much, she would give him a liberal punch. She did not want him to talk at all. The scribe, however, secured his promise to jot down anything he might wish to say, briefly, and it would be called for later in the day.
So Billings did another interview on February 28, 1888. In that interview, he said, quote, "At special request of your paper, I will at last break silence enough to say that after scanning with the critical eye of a lawyer of 25 years' practice, the voluminous testimony taken before the coroner, I have yet to find one word indicating that I am in any way responsible for the death of Kingsley. I had no idea what the testimony was until within 2 days, well knowing I had never attempted or desired to take life, although nearly losing my own. I knew that no harm could come to me, but little did I think there was no evidence upon which to hold me a moment. The false and garbled statements published at the time did almost untold wrong and will cost myself, as well as the taxpayers, great sums, and without any even probable cause. Others have told what they would and could against me heretofore. I shall wait to have my story told in court, as others should have done, and not to have tried to prejudice the public against one who had no chance to answer." While Billings seemed confident about his innocence, a quote from a paper at the time said, "It is the universal opinion here that if Billings is not legally guilty of murder, he is certainly morally guilty."
A trial was set for April 3, 1888. E.A. Dawson of Waverly was in charge of the prosecution, and an O. Wellington of Decorah was in charge of the defense. On April 19, 1888, C.D. Ellis of Charles City began the opening argument for the state. It lasted a day and a half. According to the Des Moines Register, he reviewed the testimony elicited during the 3 weeks' examination, leaving no point untouched. It said, quote, "Mr. Ellis contended, showing that Myron E. Billings is guilty of one of the most heinous offenses ever known on this globe, damnable, not only on the account of the murder, but that it was a blow at the reputation of a young man who held his reputation sacred, a stab at the dear old mother and all of his relatives."
W. L. Eaton of Osage followed with an opening argument for the defense and concluded in half a day. On April 25, 1888, the jury reached a compromise verdict after 36 hours. According to the Sioux City Journal, quote, "The silence that hung over the courtroom was oppressive, and for the first time the defendant began to show signs of severe mental strain as he watched the piece of paper on which his fate was inscribed. The jury found the defendant guilty of murder in the second degree."
On April 27, 1888, Billings and his attorney presented his motion for a new trial based on alleged errors in the judge's rulings and instructions to the jury, his refusal to grant a change of venue, and the presence of bailiffs in the jury room while that body was deliberating upon a verdict. They stated 19 specific reasons in total. The judge denied this motion. The judge said, quote, "I think the jury made a mistake in the verdict. It should have been murder in the first degree instead of the second." The judge also said that Mrs. Billings will be allowed to remain with her husband each day between 9 and 4 o'clock.
However, Billings appealed again and his case was brought to trial again. On October 2, 1889, a jury decided that Billings was guilty and fixed the crime at murder in the second degree. It took the jury 11 hours to deliberate, When they read the verdict, it was said that Billings sat bolt upright, his arms folded, and that there was not a sign of emotion upon his immobile countenance. His hair had been neatly combed, and he had dressed himself with scrupulous care, apparently desiring to be faultlessly attired when he received the news of his doom. The juror shook the prisoner's hand. Mrs. Billings broke out into sobs after she heard the verdict.
One article described what convinced the jury this time. One point was that there were threats made by the defendant, and the contents of the papers found in his possession furnished the missing link in the chain of circumstantial evidence that, in their minds, fastened the crime upon him. And then another point was that one of the attorneys for the defense said that he had no doubt that the result would have been different had it been possible to keep the defendant off the witness stand at the previous trial and inquest, but he insisted upon telling the story himself.
The courtroom was packed for Billings' sentencing. He was sentenced to hard labor at the Anamosa Penitentiary for life. According to the Courier, quote, before the sentence, the judge made the remarkable statement that if he had been a juror, he would have favored an acquittal. Billings remained perfectly calm at the sentencing and delivered a quick speech where he asserted his innocence. His wife once again burst into tears.
We also found a note that said in October of 1888, Mrs. Billings was arrested for alleged perjured testimony given by her in the trial of her husband for the murder of County Attorney Kingsley last December. She was in jail, but we don't think anything ever came from this arrest, really.
In 1890, Billings once again appealed to the Supreme Court, and this time they reversed the decision. He conducted his own defense with the assistance of Eaton and Wellington, and it was said that the state reversed its decision because they believed there wasn't enough evidence to prove that Billings killed Kingsley rather than Kingsley committing suicide. All of the articles at this time said that the state could have prosecuted again, but it was improbable to do so, which makes Billings practically a free man.
On October 20th, 1890, the Gazette talked to Billings while he was on a train from the penitentiary to Waterloo. They asked, was the decision of the Supreme Court what you expected? And he replied with, quote, it was. It was not only what I expected, but what I knew would be the result purely upon the merits of the case. You see, I probably know more about this case than any other man. I prepared all my own abstracts and was present during the hearing before the Supreme Court. And let me say right here that I've been treated with great fairness and consideration ever since my trial, but more particularly since my trial at Waterloo. I went about at the Capitol just the same day as any other citizen, and at the penitentiary no man could have been treated with more consideration. The warden was very kind to me indeed. I was the librarian and had liberty to go all around the premises. Sheriff Hoxie also treated me kindly. The bar generally has treated me with all respect. He went on to say, this trouble has cost me over $6,000 and I am absolutely penniless. I had sold out before the shooting, intending to go to the Pacific Coast for my health. No, I have nothing left me now but my pension. I am 54 years old, too old to begin life anew, and regard it as a burning shame for the state to turn a man out thus penniless. The great state will be called upon to make it right. My health is poor. I suffer from a wound received in the army and also from the shot received in the spine on that 21st day of September, 1887. I am an invalid from that shot and will probably remain so to the end of my days. He also said in that article, quote, I do not want to leave Iowa either, as it is the best state I ever saw.
On November 12, 1890, the case was dismissed and Billings was discharged. Billings retired to Washington State and then Northern California. He didn't have any other known legal trouble, and he died in 1919 at age 81. He was buried in Calistoga Pioneer Cemetery in Napa County, California. His first wife was Julia Clorinda Churchill. They had four children, two of whom died young. They divorced in 1870. Julia died in 1922 at age 81. He had then married Delia Emma Welcher in 1874. They had two children, one of whom died in infancy. His son, Elmore Myron Billings, died in 1920 in California at age 63. Willis Kingsley is buried at Harlington Cemetery in Waverly, Iowa. quite a dramatic story today, but let's talk to Taps and see what he thinks.
Sounds good. Hi, Taps. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Okay, we're in Bremer County this week. Have you been to that county?
I have. Not very often, but I've been there.
Do you remember anything fun from it?
Do I remember Waverly, Iowa?
Sure.
Home of Wartburg College. I was there in high school for some reason, and I can't remember why. I think it was a band thing or something.
Have we talked about what instrument you played in band?
Oh, yeah, Glenn Miller episode.
I was not good at anything, so.
Was it trumpet?
No.
Shoot.
I actually played the trombone, but got stuck with the sousaphone in marching band, the tuba.
That's a big, big guy.
It was, and the tuba section was notoriously known for being troublemakers in the band.
Why?
I don't know, but my tuba section, all three of the people in my squad or whatever are attorneys. One's a judge and the other one's a lawyer.
You're all still friends?
Yeah, I still know them all.
That's amazing. I need to re-listen to the Glenn Miller ep. It's been a minute.
All right. So this was an interesting case actually about lawyers and Billings, who supposedly killed Willis. His wife was in his prison cell helping him with the evidence. Can that happen nowadays?
I really severely doubt it. I can't imagine a scenario where a spouse would be allowed into a prison cell other than visitation. But then you have to remember, too, that we do visitation in jails much different than back then. We have, you know, video and glass. And, I mean, most of the people that visit in the jail I'm associated with now do it by video.
Can your spouse be your lawyer representing
you? Yeah, if she or he was an attorney, then probably so. I don't think it would be a good idea, but.
That's a dumb question, but I know you can represent yourself on trial. Can you get anyone to represent you, or do they have to be an attorney if it's someone else?
No, you could request anyone to be your representative, but obviously in a capital case, the judge is going to really push back on that just because the consequence is so severe.
Got it. One interesting tidbit in this case was that the juror shook Billings' hand after the verdict was read. And I was just wondering if that happens now.
No, I've never seen it. And in fact, the defendant never gets close to the jury. If the verdict's announced, usually there's two deputies on each side of the defendant when the verdict is announced, and he is or she is instantly escorted out of the courtroom after the judge reads the final proclamations and instructions.
What about like a criminal case? Say it's not murder, a criminal case where the person is not like found guilty yet and they come in. I mean, they're around the jurors, right?
Well, I mean, they're separated. The jurors are in the jury box and defendants over at the defense table, but I have never seen a defendant and jury interact other than defendants who are crazy or trying to cause a commotion or whatever may start yelling at jurors or whatever, but I've never seen any interaction between a juror. It would be so prejudicial that I don't think you could possibly support that case.
Interesting. When were women allowed on a jury? Do you know?
Not till recently.
What?
And by recently, I mean the last 100 years, but it was really part of the suffrage movement and stuff that really began when women were allowed to sit as jurors. So it's not been that long ago. I mean, it was really a movement in the 20s and 30s in most of the states. So,
wow.
That seems really weird considering most women didn't have jobs. So wouldn't it be much easier for them to be on a jury?
It would have been. And back then, I think it was easier to form a jury pool just because most people were involved in agriculture and small businesses and things like that. Now, you know, there's so much difficulty trying to find enough people to be in a jury pool. It's amazing.
Is it? And it's not a rule that you have to have so many jurors as women, is it?
No. The only restriction currently in juries is called the Bastin rule. It's addressed after a Supreme Court case where you cannot exclude jurors based on race.
Do you have any theories on what actually happened between Billings and Kingsley?
No, I mean, if you read the stuff, there are so many things. I mean, it could have been a suicide. It could have been a self-defense. It could be a murder. But there just wasn't enough evidence. And I was, frankly, fairly amazed that they got a conviction, even in the 1800s, originally. But then when it went up on appeal, obviously he wasn't exonerated, but it was sent back for retrial. And evidently the county attorney or the prosecutor didn't want to retry it.
What would your theory be? Do you have one?
No, I really don't, because I don't know. There's not enough information to really say what happened. I mean, I thought it was interesting that obviously the guns were revolvers and two of the cylinders were already empty. And so there's a lot of things that could have happened in that case.
Beth, what do you think?
I mean, I know he's like super dead, but I think he probably did it. Billings did. He seemed sus and he seemed like he was out to get Kingsley prior to this incident.
I'm with you.
So super dead's like more than dead?
Super dead.
When did he die? It was like 18.
I think he died in 1919.
Okay, yeah. Super dead. What would be your approach to figure out if it was a murder versus suicide?
Well, I mean, they wouldn't have had the tools back then. I mean, nowadays you might do gunshot residue, you might do DNA on the handgun, gunshot residue, you'd look for, you know, was there powder on the guy's hand? You might reconstruct the angle of the bullets and stuff to see if they fit where the defendant says he was when he shot. There's just a lot of different things we could do that they didn't have that ability to do back then. So I think with what they had, they did as best they could.
Any final thoughts on this one?
Kind of ironic that lawyers are killing other lawyers, but it's pretty interesting that this guy walks away from prison after a while and goes and disappears into the night, although he did say he likes Iowa.
Now you just made me think of another question. Have you ever heard of another case where lawyers kill a lawyer?
I had a lawyer homicide, but it wasn't, and it's unsolved. But our thoughts were it wasn't another lawyer that killed him. It was a client. No, I can't think of one right now.
It's kind of surprising because my armchair theory would be that lawyers are so arrogant that they think they can get away with it, you know? Not that lawyers are arrogant, but they...
Well, I mean, they're definitely... Most lawyers are type A personalities and stuff, but there's a lot of people in this world that thought they could get away with murder, and not very many have.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining. We'll talk to you next time.
Goodbye.
Oh, hello there. As a marketer, I hate promotions like this.
Same and same.
But I love content.
Me too.
So if you like our content, give us a like, follow, share, subscribe, note, fax, literally anything you think would help us continue making Daiwa a success.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.